This podcast is sponsored by the Music Player Network at musicplayer.com, the premier musician resource for keyboard players and beyond. Since the year 2000, the Music Player Network has been the go-to source for news and views on music technology, playing tips, and gigging help. The Keyboard Corner is one of the longest-running keyboard forums in internet history, with guitar, bass, drum, and numerous recording and music tech forums also on offer. Frequented by weekend warriors, manufacturers' representatives, and professionals alike, MPN provides an invaluable resource for any musician, and it's 100% free to sign up and use. Go to www.musicplayer.com to see for yourself.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Keyboard Chronicles, a podcast for keyboard players of the gigging variety. I'm your host David Holloway and once again it's brilliant to be here with you. This episode features our first Australian guest and is also the first person on the show I've had the pleasure of being in the same room with as they make the music that they do. Paul Bindig is a keyboard player with arguably one of the best Pink Floyd tribute bands going around, Echoes of Pink Floyd. As you can imagine, replicating the work of Pink Floyd over their entire discography is challenging, but Paul manages it with ease. We delve into how he does that, amongst other things in the interview, and I think you'll enjoy it. Paul, thanks for joining me, and I got to say, what a pleasure it is, or an unusual thing it is at least, to have someone with the same accent as me on the same show.
Well, thank you, David, for inviting me, and I'm really looking forward to chatting. I'm very honoured to be invited.
Yeah, oh, no, look, my pleasure. As I said in the intro, you actually have the honour of being the first guest that I've actually met in the flesh prior to doing an interview. So we've obviously caught up once in the flesh and talked a bunch over the phone over the months. So
Sure. And let's not forget you rescued me when I had to backline a Kronos and it didn't quite play the way I wanted it to.
Oh, so, that's right. Yeah, actually, let's mention that briefly, not because of what I did because it was very little, but yeah, so actually start off with that story because I think our listeners will enjoy that one.
Oh, for sure. So for the benefit of our listeners, David helped me out very nicely. My party band was booked to do an interstate corporate gig, which was fantastic. Obviously, not using my own gear, given that we had to travel a good number of kilometres up to the Gold Coast to do the show. And they backlined a called Kronos for me, which is fantastic, but I play Chrome. So I thought, well, this won't be too bad. I should be able to get used to the operating system and the way it works. And via the amazing Keyboard Corner forum that we're both members of, I asked for a bit of advice on what to expect and got lots of great advice. However, the Kronos did trip me up with something to do with the piano samples not being loaded, and I was getting a little bit stressed. And then I reached out to David, who had offered his help if I got stuck. And sure enough, a few text messages later, and mate, you're looking at the manual and screenshotting it for me, and all was resolved, and the gig went ahead. Guests happy, client happy, and keyboard player happy. So it was a very happy ending to that story.
Yeah, nice. And yeah, go the Kronos, and we'll talk a little bit more about Korg stuff in the future. But yeah, even though it's a relatively easy to use board, it still has its idiosyncrasies like any board, that's for sure.
Yeah, indeed.
And speaking of interstate corporate gigs, I thought it might be interesting to start off, for the sake of our non-Australian listeners, about what it's like in Australia doing gigs. And we'll probably start off here about mentioning what I'm assuming is your main gig, which is the Echoes of Pink Floyd tribute show. And I did mention it in the intro. So as part of that show, you are travelling quite extensively. Now, unlike, say, the US or UK, for us to be able to do that sort of gigging at the regular level that we'd like requires some insane levels of kilometres. So I know before the show we talked about how you are based in Adelaide, South Australia, and you've needed to drive, say, to Perth on the West Coast or Queensland on the East Coast, Upper East Coast, and, you know, roughly what, 4,000 kilometres each way?
Yeah, so for example, if we're travelling to Perth, well, we did this last year, so we get in the car and we drive out to Perth, and that's about, you're getting towards sort of just under 3,000 k's from Adelaide to Perth. Okay. But then we, after Perth, we head down further south and we end up doing places like Bunbury and Albany, which is, you know, Albany for those who don't know Australia, well, is in the absolute bottom left-hand corner of the country. And then you go down there, and then you come back up through and then back across to Adelaide, which sort of sits in the middle at the bottom of the country. So you're looking at about, you know, 6,000-8,000 k's roughly, depending on what way we go and where we stop and that sort of thing on the way through. So it's a huge distance that we cover, no doubt about it.
And for our US listeners, I did a bit of Googling before the show, and that's the equivalent if Paul were and his crew were to jump in their van and drive the gear like they do. That's equivalent of driving from Los Angeles to, say, West Virginia, so not far off getting to New York for one weekend gig. Or I mean, sometimes you'll probably do, what, two? You might do the Friday and Saturday, but...
yeah, absolutely. So yeah. We always try and do two to obviously, you know, make, get value out of our transport and travel costs and that sort of thing. And, you know, there's all sorts of logistical challenges, you know, as you alluded to, David, with touring around Australia. And the hardest thing about gigging in Australia, especially a tribute act, so we're in a Pink Floyd tribute, and whilst we would love to play in Adelaide every weekend, Adelaide's a town of a million people, and it's a long way from, you know, the next big city, which is Melbourne. It's 800 k's from Melbourne. You know, Melbourne's about 4 million people or thereabouts. So you can't be gigging a Pink Floyd tribute every weekend in your own town, because, you know, at some point people are not going to keep watching it, because, you know, you're not going to go every weekend and watch the same band playing the same music. So we, because Australia is such a huge country but also so sparsely populated, we're on the road all the time touring the show. And that brings with it challenges, because given the distances we have to travel, and, you know, like you said, we'll only play a couple of gigs in a weekend, and, you know, we've got day jobs and things as well. So what that basically means is we're really having to think cleverly about how we make the costs work when we travel, and, you know, what's smart to do, what's not smart to do, where we should play, where we shouldn't play, and, you know, just the physical logistics of what we take, what we don't take, how we get there. So there's a fair bit goes into it, David.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said, particularly when in something like the band you are, you can't necessarily backline everything you want, or it can be challenging. So you are cutting your own gear. It makes it interesting. So anyway, I thought that might be interesting for non-Australian listeners. I mean, we're not unique with vast geographies. It's just somewhere like the US, obviously the market is much larger, 330, whatever it is, million people versus, what, 25 million now, I think, in Australia.
Yeah, and I think that's the key difference. I mean, you know, the US is actually bigger than Australia, but there's just much more population.
Yeah.
And so, I imagine, not that we've ever toured the US, but I imagine we're probably doing more travelling to play less gigs than you might have to if you're doing something similar in the States. But I look at, you know, to be honest, though, respect to anyone who goes out and does it. I don't care where they live. It's fun, but it's hard.
Yes, exactly. So let's go back a little bit and do the short history of Paul Bindig. Tell us how you started out with music, Paul. You know, what got you into it and what got you to where you are today?
Yeah, well, look, probably like a lot of people, got into it as a real young bloke, and I couldn't honestly tell you, David, how old I was, but I would have been knee high to a grasshopper in junior primary school. So, you know, I was probably 7 or 8 years old.
There's a good piece
like
of Aussie terminology.
And look, what happened was, me and my brother both had piano lessons as young fellas, and I can't even remember now whose idea it was to have the lessons first. But anyway, our parents were, and look, our parents didn't have a lot of money, but they were really supportive of us getting some piano lessons, and that continued on, just getting private piano lessons for up until my teens, I suppose, when I, fair to say, I'd had enough of it. And other things were starting to come into my radar, like, you know, social lives and, you know, the study at school and sport and all these sorts of things. And maybe playing classical tunes wasn't really turning me on that much. But what it did do is it gave me a real, you know, appreciation and love of playing music. And at high school, I was in the high school rock band and really enjoyed that and made some good friendships that way. And then really from my late teens, 17, 18, I got into a band with some friends, like a lot of people do, and just started playing pubs and doing gigs. And that's kind of how it all started, was just enjoying playing music and getting into rock bands and rock music. And I actually started out playing blues. It was what I first started playing, which I loved and still love. And, yeah, so that was really how it all happened. So it was just like a lot of us, I think, David, you start from a young age, enjoy it, and just keep chipping away at it.
Yeah. And so you're into, I've mentioned Echo's Pink Floyd, and then you're in a more intermittent, I believe, rock covers band?
Yeah, so we've got a rock party band called Fingerbun, of all things. And we play reasonably infrequently, maybe every 1 to 2 months. And that's a bit more of a fun hobby. It's probably the best way to describe that one. It's just something that, look, me and the guys in that band, we've been together since the mid 90s. And we're mates first and musicians second. And we just have a great time. We play as much as we want to. And, you know, once a year we do a bit of a big gig at the Adelaide Fringe Festival, which is a big thing here. And other than that, we just play the pubs and the clubs and, yeah, just classic party tunes and have a bit of fun with it.
Yeah. And, again, another important cultural reference you made there to finger bun. So I think that's a British thing, the finger bun. But, again, for our US and Canadian and other non-European listeners, so finger bun, how would you term it? It's basically a sweet roll, lengthy sweet roll with some sort of icing on top of it, usually a pink sort of icing with coconut.
Perfectly described. and there might be a couple of little raisins or something stuck in there as well.
That's true. Good point.
Yeah. But yes, it's, you know, the name finger bun, we constantly get asked by people, where did this name come from? And most people assume it's some kind of clever in-joke or it's a allusion to something slightly naughty.
That's why I was mentioning it.
but it really isn't. And so the story behind the name goes like this. So our band, when we first formed it back in the mid-90s, we called it Millennium Bug. Because at the time that the whole Y2K bug was starting to get a bit more traction in the media and all the rest of it. And we just thought it sounded cool, so we called ourselves Millennium Bug. We thought, yeah, that's all right. So the only problem with that name is it had a pretty hard use-by date.
Yeah.
So we had a bit of a sabbatical, and then we sort of started again and slightly changed the sort of music we were playing, and we needed a new band name. And look, I'm sure any of your listeners, David, who play in bands can relate to this. Naming a band can be like naming a child. It's a really hard thing to do. And if you know, you think about mum and dad trying to name a child, and, you know, dad's got his list of names, mum's got her list of names, and they get their lists together and no one can agree because, I went to school with a kid called Mary, so there's no way we call the kid Mary. I hated her and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, you multiply that by, say, 5 band members, it just gets harder.
Yes.
And it got to the point where I actually said, boys, I'm really sick of this conversation. The next name that someone comes up with, I don't care what it is, I don't care how stupid it is, we're just going with that because we need to actually get a name so we can start booking some gigs. And our bass player, Brad, said, okay, we're going to call it Finger Bun. And so that's what we called it. So he just picked it out of the ether.
It's good as anything. Yep, yeah, exactly. And there's many worse band names.
I'm not sure about that, but anyway.
No, I've been in at least one band with worse. All right, cool. So let's talk about rigs, one of the favourite topics of conversation. Yeah. So maybe if you want to start off with a summary of what you do for Echoes of Pink Floyd rig-wise, which I'm guessing is your larger rig versus your pared-down version.
Yeah, sure. So I think the best thing to preface this with is to say my rig is ridiculously simple and ridiculously manual. So I don't have any clever tricks around program changes with MIDI or foot switches hooked up or anything like that. It's very, very manual and very, very simple. And it's 100% hardware based. So there's no software at all as part of the sounds and all the rest of it, for better or worse. But It's funny because I read about other guys' rigs and I'm envious really of the cleverness of what people are doing and how they're triggering things and one touch triggers to move through things and all the rest of it. And I sort of know if I put the time and energy into it, I'd probably get a return on the investment. It'd be worth doing. But maybe I'm just a bit lazy by nature, David. But it's pretty simple. So to start with, it's an old Korg rig, and the heart of it really is a little old Korg Chrome, which does the heavy lifting in both my bands actually. So just a real simple 61 key, light as a feather. But what's good about the Chrome is for what you pay for it when you buy it, it packs an enormous punch in terms of sonic flexibility, and I find it just so easy to work with. Like it's just so easy to get around. It's just really easy to program different sounds and combinations and stuff to create all the different sounds we have to make. So I just love it for that reason. I get along with it. It's reliable and it sounds great. It's a really good fit. Considering it's not the top of the line Korg weapon, it just sounds fantastic. So yeah. I really enjoy playing that. That's like my 61 key sort of do it all kind of keyboard. From a piano and an electric piano perspective, I've got the Korg SV1, the 88 key version. So that sits under the Chrome, and yeah, that's doing all my acoustic piano sounds, electric piano sounds, which are obviously pretty important for any rock band really, but certainly Pink Floyd. There's plenty of that stuff there. And then for the wild and wacky vintage synthesizer stuff, I use a King Korg, which is I reckon a bit of an underrated keyboard. It's doesn't get a lot of love, but it's for me it gets plenty of love. It's a little 61 key thing. It's the same kind of, I don't know, it comes out of the same plastic mold as what the Chrome does. It's got the same sort of cheap key bed. But what's good about it is it really is very clever at recreating some of those sounds of the vintage synths like the Moogs and the Oberheims and all that sort of stuff and the old Korg MSs as well and that sort of thing. So it's fantastic. It's really easy to play with and tweak the sounds, and it's great for real-time fiddling as well when you're playing. So it's really good like that. So between those three keyboards, they cover all my keyboard sounds, if you like. And then the only other thing I do, which is a little bit different, is I have a heap of samples, obviously. So playing a Floyd tribute, you need to recreate your cash registers and money and all sorts of various planes and bombs and stuff like that. And all I do there is I have an iPad. So it's a really old iPad. It's the old iPad 2.
Oh, yeah.
And I just come out of that with a 3.5mm jack, which goes into my line mixer, which I'll talk about in a second. And I've just got an old program which I don't even think is supported by iOS anymore called Sample Lab, and it's just like a 8-pad sample pad thing on an iPad. So I just trigger all of my samples off of that. So the whole rig runs into an Ashley line mixer.
Oh yeah.
I think it's LX308B or whatever it's called off the top of my head, and again it's all analog. All runs into that. And that's a fantastic little mixer. It's quiet as a mouse, really, really good. And then I'll just go stereo out of that to front of house. And there's a mono line out, which then I put into just my own monitor, which just sits on the top of my rack, which the line mixer's mounted in, so I can hear myself that way.
Yeah.
And front of house just gives me a wedge to hear the rest of the band, and that's my rig, David.
Yeah, cool. And just on the sample. So when you say the iPad and Sample Lab, so for example, money, you mentioned the cash register. So are you saying the whole sample is there and you're just triggering it and your drummer's playing along to it, or you're triggering it each time it needs to musically?
Oh, look, it depends very much on the song and the sample. Yeah. So our drummer runs a Roland SPD-SX,
okay.
which is I guess almost like a physical version of what I'm doing on the iPad. So depending on the complexity of the song and the complexity of the task I have to do, either he'll trigger a sample or I will.
Right.
I probably trigger 70 to 80% of our samples, and Jason, our drummer, probably gets the other 20 to 30%. Look, it really depends on the sample. So using money as an example, you've got that familiar intro with the ripping paper and the coins and the cash register and all that sort of stuff. So I just press the go button. It starts. The bass player joins in, And once we get rolling, I'll just turn it off. Simple as that. So yeah, it's very manual. Very, very manual.
Oh, that's cool. Simple is good. And you also mentioned the wedge. I know you and I have had conversations about in-ears, and that it's always a contentious topic. Are in-ears something, I think you've said you probably wouldn't like the isolation of them?
I'm a bit scared of them, to be honest. And again, in saying that, everyone I know, and I think you're one of those people, David, everyone I know who's gone to in-ears says, you've got to do it. They're life-changing. They're fantastic. And I don't disbelieve that. But I'm very much if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
That's right.
Type of chap, and we don't have loud on stage volume, so I'm not too worried about that.
So that's
good. I'm just kind of in my comfort zone, but I'm not ruling out going to in-ears at some point. But
I feel like
maybe it's more important for vocalists. I don't know.
I think you're right. I think it is more important for vocalists. And if you're lucky enough to be in a band that doesn't have big on stage volumes, I can see that they're less needed. I'm in a band that has large volumes, and it's, as I said, it's changed my life in that I can actually hear everything, and I'm enjoying playing, 10 times more than I was with a wedge. But that's purely volume related.
Oh, and I think too, there'd be no doubt you'd be able to hear yourself with such clarity playing with in-ears. And I'm probably one of these guys, if I can't hear myself well, I tend to probably overplay a bit to compensate, which is not good. So I can certainly see the benefits, but I guess I just haven't ventured down that road yet, mate.
No, understandable. And so over your time, particularly in Echoes of Pink Floyd, what are some of the more interesting times you've had as far as whether it's challenges on the night or songs that you find particularly challenging and take a great deal of pride in having nailed or...
Yeah, look, this. I mean, we've been doing this for about 5 years now, and there's, I could probably bore you with all sorts of interesting stories. Fortunately, we haven't had anything go horrifically wrong. One of the most challenging times we had actually was we were playing a show at Geelong, and we just started, and we were doing our recreation of the Wall show. This was only this year. And I think we're into another Brick in the Wall part one with that moody sort of bass drone going on and all the rest of it. And there's a bit of theatricality in that show. And so our lead singer was sort of, getting right into it. And all of a sudden, I just heard this audience member just yelling and screaming. And it was like the room was almost dead quiet apart from the bass drone. And I thought, oh, this bloke's drunk. I thought, I'll deal with him pretty quickly. That'll be right. And it just kept going and it kept going. And this guy's hollering and carrying on and all the rest of it. And I'm starting to get a bit distracted in terms of, what's going on with this guy? Why is this guy yelling? And then I was able to sort of, I'm at the back of the stage, mm-hmm. and B, I tend not to look at the audience very much when I'm playing. I've got too much stuff to go on with. But I managed to find out who he was. And he was a fellow in a wheelchair, and he obviously had a fairly major intellectual disability.
Okay.
And I thought, that makes sense. That explains. And his carer was trying to calm him down a bit and take him for a bit of a roll in his wheelchair out of the way. What was happening is other members of the audience were getting distracted as well. And you could see some of them were starting to get a bit annoyed.
Yeah.
But then they were having the same thing as me. They were realizing it was this gentleman with a intellectual disability, and they're going, fair enough, and all the rest of it. But it was just really challenging because it was really loud and interfering with what we were trying to do. So just trying to stay really focused on the music and the timing and getting it all right. And, Matt, our lead singer, has some dialogue he does in between songs. And so it was really interesting. And anyway, at the halftime break, I just went up to him and said, and his care, and said, hello, introduced myself. And he was like, look, a lovely fellow. And he just had a form of Tourette's.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And he was really enjoying the show and all the rest of it. And I said, oh, keep enjoying it, mate. it's going to be good. And, it ended up being really good. And, had a great chat to his carer. And it just shows you all the different kinds of people who come and enjoy the music and what they love. And the boys and I were talking about it afterwards. And I said, well, isn't it great that his carer and he were able to come to the show, enjoy it. The audience were cool about it, and it was a good experience for them as well. So that was. I just thought that was
it's a nice story.
Well, it was an interesting story in that we didn't know what was going on. It was challenging conditions, but it worked out really well in the end.
And it could have been much more challenging, because you're right, you tend to default to that it's someone drunk that's maybe going to cause an issue.
Well, and we've had drunk people at our shows before, and because of the style of shows we play, they're always in theatres, and the ushers tend to give them the heave-ho pretty quick. And so when it kept going, it's when you sort of go, okay, well, this isn't a drunk person, something else is going on here. But he was a top fella, actually, really nice guy. Yeah, and so it was just a really interesting, you know, to hear it from his, to hear what he enjoyed about the music from his perspective.
That's
and
right.
His calling out was him getting excited and loving the music. So just one of those things. But it was good. It was good. Do you know, one other thing that strikes, probably the main thing that strikes about playing Pink Floyd music, David, so it's not so much a touring thing, it's more of a Pink Floyd thing. But we always meet the audiences after the show.
I had to ask you about this. Is pedantry. Yeah, go for it.
And, yeah, there's definitely a lot of pedantry goes on there. But the one of the best, most interesting stories, I think, that I can remember meeting the audience is we had a couple who were from somewhere in Eastern Europe, and I can't exactly remember where it was, but it was from the old Behind the Iron Curtain days, so prior to, you know, the fall of that Soviet bloc. And they were a couple in their 60s, I suppose. And they were saying that they had to hide they had some Pink Floyd records.
Right.
Which were not really allowed. And so, because I guess Western music and rock music was frowned upon by the regime there, and they had to hide their Pink Floyd record collection. And they were saying that when they actually defected, so they came to the West before it was easy to do so, and before the curtain came down. Mm-hmm. And they were saying that they had to go through all this different stuff, and they were hiding. And they said, and it was, and they brought their Pink Floyd records, about the only thing they brought with them, which is just what they wanted to hear to get them through the stress and the angst of having to. So, and that's what the music meant to them. So they've come to our show and they said they're in tears remembering those times. And it's quite funny because we're just a bunch of, you know, hacks trying to play a bit of music. You know, you don't feel like it's weird, isn't it? Like you're just a custodian of something that's very special to other
people.
That's
right.
Yeah. So it's really, really quite eye-opener.
And I mean, I think you're a long way up of being hacks, because I think, from what I gather, you obviously will get your pedants who say, look, I don't like the way you did this or whatever, but my observation is you get a lot more positive feedback than people picking apart the odd idiosyncrasy about the way you approach the songs.
Oh, yeah, and look, I think with any tribute act, you're going to attract certain people, David, are philosophically opposed to tribute acts to start with.
True.
And it's you're not going to change those people's minds, so we don't try.
No.
We feel like, well, if you're not into tribute bands and you think that we're, you know, fleecing the memory of Pink Floyd or whatever it is you think we're doing, well, then maybe don't come to the show.
That's
not for you. It's not designed for you. And then you will get certain other people who they might say, well, you didn't play that note the right way or that sound or whatever. But overwhelmingly, we get lovely positive feedback, which is nice. And, you know, I take the view that, I mean, you can look at any clip on YouTube of anything you like. It could be a cat video or a band you like or whatever, and if it's had a certain critical mass of views, there'll be some dislikes in there.
That's right.
And you know, it's almost I almost take it as a compliment. If people want to take the time to try and pull you backwards a bit, then, well, I don't know. I mean, they're paying attention to you, I suppose.
That's right.
So that's something.
And we'll get onto Desert Island Discs later, but a sort of a sideline to that is, which of the Pink Floyd discography, as far as particular songs, do you enjoy the most, and secondly, what is the most challenging song that you have to play?
Look, my favourite Pink Floyd album is Animals.
Yep.
And that would be unusual. I think most people are probably into Dark Side of the Moon or Wish You Were Here or The Wall, and look, I love those as well, don't get me wrong, but Animals is my absolute favourite. My favourite track on that album is Dogs.
Yep.
In terms of challenging to play, that would be up there, that song. We've had to do it in the past with two keyboard players.
Mm.
And again, it's about how accurately do you want to recreate what's there? And, you know, do you want to get down the road of recording a backing track and playing along to that or not? And we've chosen the or not path. So that means an extra musician and that sort of thing. So there's challenge in that.
That's right.
I think, look, Pink Floyd as a keyboard player, Pink Floyd is not what I'd call technically challenging in the sense that you don't need to be a virtuoso to do it. And quite frankly, if you did, I wouldn't be able to be in the band. So that's good for me. But, you know, where it is challenging is that the soundscapes are quite lush and clever, and you need to get those right. And there's a bit going on, and, you know, Pink Floyd were doing a lot of tricky things in the studio, which, you know, ironically, when they played live, certainly in the 70s, that they weren't trying to recreate what was on the album because it just wasn't possible.
That's right.
Not with four blokes on stage, it certainly wasn't anyway.
And so with your approach of not using backing tracks, does that tend to preclude you a little bit from, like, the post-Waters era a little bit as far as Momentary Lapse of Reason and Division Bell and that, because they do have some massive soundscapes there that, you know, you'd nearly have to run backing tracks?
Yeah, well, it hasn't yet, but then in saying that, we probably haven't, at this point, we haven't dived too heavily into the post-Waters stuff. So we do play some tracks from the post-Waters era, but not a lot.
No.
But it's interesting you say that, David, because we're building a new show at the moment, which will tour in the second half of 2020 and into 2021, and we're going to get a bit more heavily into that stuff.
Okay.
And to be advised is the answer to that question. I just don't know what we're going to do yet. I mean, look, my preference would not be to go with tracks.
No.
But we'll just have to see what we can come up with. And, you know, we'll and look, the other thing too, with these real lush, very highly produced soundscapes that they were creating around that time, you know, if you layer a couple of good pads, you could probably get away with it as long as the guitar solos are on point and the lyrics and singing is on point. So we'll probably have to make some decisions there. But yeah, no tracks at this point in time.
Yeah.
So the only electronic trickery is click tracks and samples and arpeggiators at the moment.
That's right. Mm. Yeah, cool. Mm. And so during all that time, what are some of the biggest lessons you've learned as a player? Particularly in relation to gigging, although it can be technical as well. But, yeah, what have you learnt from your experience so far that you'd love to pass on to someone starting out?
Oh, I think with gigging, and this could apply to you know, any of the bands, like, you know, playing a few shows in a pub or a coffee shop or touring around the country like we do, being organised is so important. So The way the Pink Floyd tribute tours is we don't tour a sound guy, we don't tour a lights guy. And the reason for that is it's just prohibitive. You start adding personnel to your crew. And the way we do it, we'd have to charge $120-$150 a ticket if we're going to start doing that. And that's not a space we want to be in just yet. And, you know, you want to give people good value for money and that sort of thing. So we have a 30-page rider that hits a venue before we do, and it's very, very planned out. Every possible thing you can imagine is on that rider. So we make sure the venues know exactly what we need, and I'm not talking about separating the blue M&Ms. You know, I'm simple things like you know, the stage plot is really precise around where people stand and what size riser they need, and we have a big circular truss we hang, and This is how high off the ground it should sit, and this is when the videos start. This is when they finish. So the lights guy knows not to shine lights on the circular projector and wash out the videos. And you know, when it down to the second when each song stops and starts, and when the solos are on, so they can light up the specials for the artists and that sort of thing. So just getting really, really, really organised, and that includes touring logistics, transport, accommodation, having all that organised in advance. And, you know, how that relates to playing the pub is simple things like no surprises when you turn up. So, you know, understand what the size of the stage is going to be, what the venue's prepared to do, what they're not prepared to do. You know, make sure you know when you're supposed to start, know when you're supposed to finish, you know when your break times are supposed to be, and sticking to it. You know, we've played a lot of venues, you know, I'm talking pub venues now in my party band, where we finish at midnight and we get a big – it's happened more than once where the owner or the manager of the bar go, oh, thank you guys so much for finishing on time.
Yeah.
Because it's just a pain in the neck for them to –
that's right.
You know, because, you know, often a band will have a good night and people will be calling for one more song, and, you know, they do that. And that's fine. But then, you know, the bar's then, you know, paying staff over time.
That's right.
And they're closing late, and it's, you know, potentially some liquor license issues as well. So just the more organised you can be, and the more everyone in their band can shoulder the wheel and be part of that organisation process. And if everyone does their little bit, it's not a big job. It's when one person has to do everything that it gets hard. Yeah. So that's just,
And it's a valuable lesson. And the next question I have, I want to put a couple of provisos on, because having met you previously, I know you're very modest, but I only have people on this podcast who are either markedly or significantly better players than me. So just put that as a proviso. So I want you to keep to only one thing you feel you could do better as a keyboard player.
Oh, can I just say everything?
Yeah, no. So that's why I put that proviso on
it. Yeah, all right. All I'll say is I need to get better at playing organ.
Yeah.
So I have very little idea about organ playing, other than I play B3 sounds in all of the music I play, playing in a rock band and a Pink Floyd band. But I'm absolutely just bluffing my way through it. I'm playing organ like a piano player, like with the sustain pedal and everything. That's hilarious, right? So, and I'm sort of trying to teach myself some basic things, but I'm pretty ordinary. So that's something for me to keep working on. And I have been sort of going over some things and trying to teach myself just from stuff online, just trying to teach myself to be better at it. But mate, it's funny. I often, in various keyboard forums, I'll read someone saying, we've got to play a real B3 at this particular venue. And I always laugh to myself, David, because I think, gee, if I turned up at a venue and there's a real B3 there, I'd be terrified because I wouldn't even know how to switch the thing on.
Well, I mean, I think it was in last episode, I was talking to our guest about it being a religious experience. And you're right, I was scared the first time I had to sit down in front of one, and then was converted once I laid hands on it. But like you, I don't know how to play an organ properly. I understand the Leslie. I understand how to get the best out of that to some extent. But I mean, yeah, I'm a bit like you. As far as the real tricks of it, I'm a long way off.
Yeah. So it was a fascinating thing, isn't it? I mean, it's obviously there's a whole technical and emotional depth to playing a real Hammond organ.
Yeah.
That it's there to be learned, right? So that's exciting. Sometimes not knowing something is exciting because you can discover it and enjoy the discovery. Like, the first time you heard an amazing song, it's like, I wish I could have that time back again. So yeah, it's something exciting to uncover. And I'm sure, I mean, look, I've heard plenty of them at going to gigs and they sound amazing. Who knows, one day.
You never know. And who are your actual inspirations as a keyboard player, Paul? So whether nationally, internationally, historical?
My favourite keyboard players just are guys like Greg Allman.
Oh, yep.
Greg Rowley.
Yep.
I really admire Derek Sherinian. I think he's fantastic. Mm. Like just all the different stuff he's done over the journey, and he just seems really versatile and talented. But look, and this is not false modesty. This is true. It's very rare I'll go to watch a band and I'll watch the keyboard player and I'll go, I wish I was as good as that guy or that girl. There's some amazing players out there.
Oh yeah,
and I just get inspired by anyone. Like, if I go watch a band and they've got a keyboard player, I'll go chat to them afterwards and ask them, what they're doing and, what sort of rig have you got and how do you do this and how do you do that? It's, I'm constantly inspired by people.
And generally they're receptive to that, because I know, and in my very small space, I'd love it if keyboard players come up, because it doesn't happen very often. So
exactly.
Yeah, so I'm sure you've never had any pushback on that. Most people would be happy to chat.
Never, no. Because, and it's all about how you approach people, right? I mean, I don't come up and go, oh, mate, yeah, I did this and I did that. I'd never say anything like that. I just come up and say, oh, I thought you did really good and I play a little bit of keyboard too, and would it be okay if you talk to me about what you do? Yeah. And, you just be a nice, normal person.
That's right.
People are always happy to talk to you. It's never an issue. And it's saying that I'm not a serial pest botherer of musicians after I finish gigs either. But if I happen to bump into them at the bar, then I will definitely have a chat to them.
So, absolutely. Mm. And one thing I would normally ask is, what's got you excited technologically right now as far as keyboards? But I want to link it in with something I've noticed about you over the last year, is that you do have a very disciplined anti-gear addiction syndrome or GAS approach in that you don't fall for the latest thing. So how do you maintain that discipline? Because I struggle with that severely.
Oh, look, it's partially a discipline, which is very kind of you to put it that way, but it's also partially maybe a lack of willingness to get outside of a comfort zone. So in some ways, it might be not a positive thing, if that makes sense. It's positive in that it probably saves me a heap of cash. But, so where it comes from is I look very much at the music I play as it has to it is partially a hobby and a pastime, but it's also a business.
That's right.
And every business has to have a return on investment. And if I can't see a return on the investment, I won't invest. Mm. So I'm not going to drop, $8,000 Australian on the latest keyboard that's come out because I really can't see the justification when I could get, 95% as good, I think, 95% as good an output from my little old Chrome. So I just really look at it like that. Now, in saying that, we all have to upgrade from time to time and, things get obsolete. And if you stick too much in the past, then you're going to be in trouble one day when you need to backline something or replace something or whatever. So you can't be too rigid about it. But for me, I'm very much if my gear works and I like it. So this is how I look at it. If I play a show and I think, gee, that sounded good and I liked it and I got good feedback from the audience and my bandmates think it sounds good. That was today. If tomorrow they bring out the new latest whiz-bang ABCD keyboard, does that mean that yesterday didn't happen? Well, not really. I mean, yesterday my stuff still sounded fantastic. So the fact the new keyboard hit the market doesn't mean I have to chuck my old stuff out if I like how it sounds.
That's right.
So that's kind of the mindset, I suppose. That's how I do it. But, in saying that, sometimes a new bit of gear will come out and it will really make your life a lot easier. So there's a cost in there or an investment, but the return is, I might save all this time or I can my workflow's improved so much by being able to use this kind of keyboard as opposed to that kind of keyboard. And I guess that's a decision every player has to make for themselves. And you know what, David, the return on investment for someone else who isn't me might be the absolute pleasure of having a beautiful, very expensive bit of gear that does all the latest stuff, but the sheer joy and pleasure they get out of having this top of the range does everything is worth the return on investment. So it's different for everyone, you know?
Well, you're right, it is different. I mean, from personal experience, I splurged on a Kronos LS88 and I love it to bits, but through gas I managed to convince myself it would be perfect for gigging because it was slightly lighter than even the 76 normal Kronos. But at the end of the day, I bought the damn thing. I love it to bits, but it never leaves the house because it's still 45 kilos or whatever it is at a case in, and it's ridiculous to transport. So the new Phantom was probably the last thing I've had gas over, and thankfully that's passed to some extent. But it's a beautiful looking unit. It's not quite as weighty as that, but I could just see it'll end up in another white elephant. And I don't have the money anyway to be buying those things every couple of years. But
a friend of mine just bought that Phantom, and it is a lovely looking keyboard. I guess it's a decision we all have to make for ourselves, isn't it? Now, in saying that, David, if you want to get rid of that Kronos because you're not using it, I'm happy to take it off your hands.
Yeah, absolutely.
I might pay you for it, but I'm happy to take it off your hands.
That's right. it is. I do recommend to anyone out there, particularly, although you're more of a piano player than I just, it's that beautiful combination of piano keys but not piano-weighted keys, which for someone that's in a covers band that does not a lot of piano, it's perfect.
Yeah, of course.
But,
of course.
If only they could lop 20 kilos off it.
Yeah, well, they are beautiful things, the Kronoses, no doubt about it.
If I could get a Modi X7 that had the Kronos key bed in it at the same weight, there's a holy grail.
Yeah, that's supposed to be a good keyboard too. We'll have to pick your brain about that at some point.
Yeah, Modi X7, I'm a major convert. I said a lot of people hate the key bed, and I understand it's on the cheaper side of key beds, but as a cover band gigging keyboard, I could not be happier. I still sit there and love every gig I play with what sounds I'm getting out of it. So,
well, it's interesting you say that because I had a bit of a fiddle with one in the shop when it came out. And to me, to my way of thinking, the key bed actually feels not unlike the one on my Chrome.
Yeah, that's what I would have thought. It'd be around that level, yeah.
Yeah, and so, and I know the Chrome keyboard doesn't get a lot of love, not the six, well, I don't use the weighted one. I won't even talk about that, but the 61 key one.
Yeah.
And I understand why. It doesn't get a lot of love and it is not the easiest thing to play piano on, which is why you have the SV1 because it's a bit nicer to play the piano on. But to my way of thinking, it sounds – I enjoy the keyboard so much for everything else it can do that I can live with the keybed, if that makes sense. Exactly. And maybe you're feeling the same way about the Yamaha.
Yeah, exactly. And just easy to edit. But anyway, that's for another time. But, yeah, big fan of that. So it sounds like 2020 is a big year for you. So you're working on a new show for Echoes of Pink Floyd. That alone – so I assume you're going to be covering a lot of the countryside again.
Yeah, we haven't quite announced our tour yet, but we're for the first half of 2020, we're going to be in the rehearsal room doing a show. Second half will be pretty comprehensive run through Victoria and New South Wales.
Yeah, great.
And then 2021, we'll take the show out further, Western Australia, Tassie. I suspect that's the plan at this stage, Queensland. That's the plan at this stage anyway, and none of it's booked. But that's probably where we're looking at the moment. So.
Yeah, excellent. And then we're going to do the wrap-up cliche, the 5 Desert Island Discs. So, I mean, you're allowed to count animals as one of them if you like. You've already alluded to that. But, yeah, hit us with your 5.
All right. Look, you're going to have to give me animals.
Yep.
Because I just love that album so much. I'm also going to pick another Pink Floyd one, Dark Side of the Moon.
Yep.
And it's like almost a perfect album, to be honest. It's just amazing. It's, I don't know, there's not many albums you can listen from start to finish and you feel, well, this is just my opinion of it, but you feel like A, it's a coherent thing, but B, there's no filler on the album. It's just, it's all meant to be there. Dark Side of the Moon feels like that to me. Can I take with me AC/DC's Back in Black?
Oh, yeah. Well, isn't that something like the third biggest, I think it's the third biggest selling album in history?
Is it really?
It's something like that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's just revolutionary, I think. And do you know what's amazing? I think about Back in Black, and the way I think about it is, you know, AC/DC, as you know, most Aussie music fans will know, were huge in this country with Bon Scott at the helm. And he was a pretty will-o'-the-wisp, iconic, mercurial, interesting, complex front man who wrote some pretty cool lyrics too. And, you know, for him to pass on and for them to come out with a new singer and to come up with something like Back in Black, I mean, that's quite phenomenal. They were able to achieve what they did with having lost Bon Scott and got Brian Johnson. So credit to Brian Johnson, credit to AC/DC. Amazing achievement, I think.
And before we get on to your last two albums, this is a keyboard-related question as far as AC/DC. I've tended to take a purist view, aside from obvious songs like Long Way to the Top where there is a bagpipe, I'm in a band that we play a couple of AC/DC songs. I don't play. So because there's no keyboards on the original track, I tend not to play. But recently, through no fault of anyone's, but it ended up we did Highway to Hell as the last song. And I've always had a bit of a rule, and I've said this to the band, if you're not going to include all the instruments in your final song, I'm going to pack up my gear in front of you. But I've never done it. I've never done it. And I don't think, because it'd be incredibly rude to do so. But it's like, well, if you've got a band with, you know, 5 musicians, you use all 5 musicians for your last song. So anyway, through no one's fault, there was a bit of shuffling of the set list, and it ended up that Highway to Hell was going to be last. So I thought, well, bugger this. I know I knew what key it was in. And because of the line mixer I use, it's got a cue button where I can press it. And so I can hear everything through my in-ears, but nothing's coming out front. And so they were doing intros. They were just doing the main, a bit of chugging along at the start of Highway to Hell. And the singer was introducing us as a band. And I basically worked out just a really basic crunchy electric piano line on the Crewmaster 7. And I thought, well, bugger this. I'm actually going to play, and it worked quite well. So I'd love to hear from other listeners or yourself too, Paul, what your take is. Should we stay out of AC/DC songs?
My view would be yes.
Yeah.
That's a very glib, quick answer. I think, you know, I'm in the same situation as you, David, in Finger Bun, in my party band. Occasionally, it happens all the time. The boys will go, oh, we should do this song. And I'll go, fellas, no keyboard in
that. That's right.
Oh, isn't there? it's amazing how often that happens.
What's your ratio? Sorry to take another tangent. Like I'm willing to accept even up to a third of songs not having overt keyboards in it. But once you get above about a third, I really start to get annoyed.
Yeah, no, we're not that high. We've probably got, look, there's probably two or three songs that don't have any. And of them, there's probably, you know, I will occasionally add, sometimes throw an organ into the chorus or something or a whirly behind a guitar, almost like a rhythm guitar. So, but certain songs you just like, you know, I would probably say AC/DC is one of those bands you can't really do that. No. You just have to lay out. We don't have too many of those, but I'm not afraid to not play because, you know, if it doesn't make the song sound better, there's no point just playing for the sake of it. But then your band shouldn't put you in that position either, should
That's
they?
That's right. So, hear, hear. Yeah. And I love that cue button because quite often I'll amuse it. I mean, there's only probably three songs I don't play in at all, but I'll continue to play along, but obviously no one's hearing it and I'll do all sorts of stupid shit on it. To amuse the drummer that I'm sitting next to, because he can tell that I'm obviously not putting anything out front.
Well, I go to the bar, David.
Yeah, I always wonder about that. I always feel rude getting off the stage, but you're right. In a pub gig, you absolutely can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I go to the bar and I have been known to get in the dance floor.
So. Yeah, there you go. No good stuff. So, yeah, last two Desert Island discs. Sorry about that.
Can I have another Australian band, Midnight Oil, 10 to 1?
Yeah.
I just love that. That got worn out in my car when I was a kid, 16 years old, driving around. So on the cassette deck, played it. Amazing band. Can I say, if anyone, yourself, mate, or any listeners haven't checked out the movie 1984,
oh, it's great, isn't it? Midnight Oil, 1984. Yeah, I've seen it. It's gold. Yeah.
Yeah, high recommendation from me. Just amazing. Yeah. And I actually forgot, 1984, I was only 12 years old. I forgot and probably never really realised at the time just how eloquent Peter Garrett was. Yes. As a spokesman for what he believed in. That's all I'll say at this point. But, yeah, amazing.
So, it works on two levels. So for us in Australia, there's some absolutely brilliant footage of you know, the surrounds of Australia in 1984, which, you know, makes you sentimental. But from a band and musician viewpoint, you're getting this amazing hitherto unseen footage of them at their peak in some of these most incredible venues where literally sweat was dripping off the ceiling. Hot gigs, and as they go through in the documentary, that they were having to nail Rob Hurst's drum kit to the to the floor because of how hard he hit it. So yeah, very much worth a look, that movie.
Oh yeah, definitely. And look, for my last one, just to prove that I am still very mainstream and I don't have any clever hidden depths, Queen's A Kind of Magic.
Oh yes.
So, again, that's an album that I can listen to that from start to finish, and I love all of it. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. No, good calls. Love it. Well, sir, thank you for that. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, and it's always nice talking with a fellow cover band musician. I didn't actually ask you the question. Do you tend to do original stuff or something you'd like to do in the future?
Oh, look, when the aforementioned Millennium Bug first started out, we were an originals band.
Oh, there you go.
So we wrote our own music and played it, and you know, we're a bit younger then, and we had ideas of world domination in our minds. Mm. And look, great fun. Loved playing originals, and I have a lot of respect for people in originals band because it's a really hard road to hoe, to be quite honest. And look, it just got to the point where we got sick of playing for only our girlfriends and the bar manager and no one else. And so you start to seed a few covers into your set.
That's right.
And then a few more and then a few. Now we don't do any originals at all. But I do miss certain parts of it. I certainly miss the creative side of it. And, you know, creating music is great fun and writing lyrics is fun. And it's a lot, you know, it's just a good thing to do. But I think those days are behind me now, David. Yes.
Yeah. Mm. No, reasonable. Excellent. Well, thanks, Sarah, and I look forward to seeing you face to face. Oh, and sorry, I'm forgetting to mention a very important thing is this won't be the last people hear of you. So Paul and I have had a chat over the time preceding the start of this podcast and since, and Paul's going to be an intermittent co-host on the podcast, which I think you'll agree after hearing him today will be a more than worthwhile addition to the team. So yeah, thanks for joining us on that, Paul. We should have some fun.
Yeah, look, I'm really pleased that you invited me to join this venture with you. And can I say, not being nice, quite honestly, the podcasts up to this point have been awesome to listen to. So I'm hoping I'm not lowering the standard too much.
Can only get better. What I'm expecting is lots of feedback after this that when I do them solo, I was like, can you get that other guy back as well? But no, it's all good. It's going to be good fun.
No, it should be a lot of fun, mate. And I'm really looking forward to chatting keyboards and meeting some fellow keyboard players out there as well. So it should be great.
And scheduling permitting, we'll be doing our first co-hosting job next episode. But talk then, mate, but thank you.
Thanks, David. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a lot of fun to chat music and keyboards with you. Time's gone really quick, which is usually a good sign. It's a good sign. And for those who are still listening, well done, and thank you very much.
And there we have it. So a huge thanks again to Paul for both being a guest on this episode and also for his contributions in the future. So we'll definitely be back in a fortnight or so with a bit of a world-class guest that pretty much everyone that listened to this podcast will know. So I think you're going to enjoy this one a lot. I know we did. So in the meantime, if you'd like to keep in touch, please do via a few means. Our website is www.keyboardchronicles.com. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/keyboardchronicles or on Twitter at twitter.com/thekeyboardchr1. If you like good old-fashioned email, then do drop us a line at editor@keyboardchronicles.com. Thanks so much again for listening and hope to see you back here next episode.